credit scores, down payments, interest rates. Car buying can be a numbers game, but you don't have to be a math expert to get the keys to your dream car. Just use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. Crunch your numbers and get personalized results so you know exactly how much you'll pay each month for your car. It's like having a magic wand for your wallet. Presto! The car you've been wanting is now within reach. So hit the road and leave your calculator at home. AutoTrader.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. There's Jerry over there. And this is part deux of Project Blue Book. Let's go.
That's right. Where we left off, Project Blue Book has officially been launched. They're doing a pretty good job of investigating stuff at this point.
The salad days.
Salad days of official investigation.
You know, every time I hear salad days, I think of Monty Python, a sketch about, it's just called Salad Days. It's great. You should look it up.
I'll check it out. Is there blood? I need blood in my Monty Python sketch.
Need a lot of blood.
Okay,
in it.
I'm in then. So let's talk about 1952. This was a big, if you want to talk the salad days of UFO sightings.
Speaking of salad days.
This is one of the big years. There were 1,501 UFO sightings in 1952, which in 1951 there were 169. So that's a lot.
Yeah, almost an increase of 10 times.
That's right, pretty close.
An order of magnitude.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big uptick, I guess you could say. And it just so happens that the Air Force had positioned itself already to investigate this stuff with an open mind.
Yeah, and there were some big ones. Like there was one where the Air Force scrambled jets to intercept what they called brilliant objects over Washington.
Yeah,
they were on radar and seen visually in the sky. And Major General John Sanford, he was the director of intelligence, actually briefed the FBI on this one and said, it is not entirely impossible that the object sighted may possibly be ships from another planet, such as Mars.
Right.
You shouldn't have added that last
bit. No, it really, really sucked the wind out of his credibility.
Yeah, because he had it going with a pretty good sentence there, and he could have just said from somewhere else in the galaxy.
Right. But he might as well have said Uranus.
Right.
You know?
He might as well have said Martians.
So Sanford also, I got the impression he went a little bit rogue here. He held a press conference, from what I understand, of his own accord.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to reassure the general public that the Air Force was on the case and that, yes, it's true, we can't really explain all this stuff, but we're looking into it.
But he included the word however, which is very important.
Right.
Because what followed that was, however, a certain percentage have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things. It is this group of observations that we now are attempting to resolve.
Yeah.
But there is no conceivable threat to the United States.
Right.
I don't know if I would have felt better hearing that presser.
I wouldn't have.
Yeah.
I would have been like, I knew it. I knew it. The world's about to end.
Yeah, Martians.
Who knows who's going to replace Tom Cruise and Top Gun? There's just utter chaos and disorder.
That's right.
So there was an article, much the same way that the Saturday Evening Post helped put it kind of a damper on the UFO craze at the behest of the Air Force back in the 40s. The UFO fever that spiked in 1952 was helped along by a Life magazine article.
But not from the Air Force behest.
No, it was like the opposite.
Yeah.
It was called Have We Visitors from Outer Space? It was just such a 1950s headline, you know?
Yeah, and they offered, or they said they were offering scientific evidence that there's a real case for interplanetary saucers.
Yeah.
And then I think about 10 sightings that they kind of just went over in great detail.
Right. It was a very long article. It was, it really made the case that, yes, there was probably extraterrestrials visiting us.
I bet that was a big issue of Life.
Sure.
I bet they sold a lot of those.
Yeah. And they, I mean, it landed really well and really hard among the American public because they were in the grips of UFO fever again. So while this is going on, like it had kind of died down a little bit, this craze. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think the Air Force was kind of surprised when it flared up again because it had a little bit died down from 1947 to, say, 1949, 1950. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden in 52, out of nowhere, it comes back.
It's like a hemorrhoid you thought you'd taken care of.
Exactly. That's an exact analogy. It's perfect. So the CIA, they had been kind of keeping tabs on this stuff.
I wondered about this when I was reading this. I was like, where are they this whole time?
That's exactly what they wanted you to wonder yeah. and then conclude they're not doing anything.
Exactly. Because that'd be on the news, right?
Right. So it turns out that the CIA was doing something, even though it wasn't on the news. There was a guy named H. Marshall Chadwell. Where did all these people come from? Yale or something?
That's great. Yeah.
Everyone involved in this this UFO investigation came from Yale.
They sound like blue bloods.
So he was the assistant director of scientific intelligence for the CIA, and he basically said, hey, we don't know what these are, by the way. I don't know if you've been paying attention to this stuff, but we should probably investigate it.
That's right.
So he got a panel impaneled. There's really no other way to put it.
Ooh, I like that word.
In 1952, and it was led by a physicist, a very famous, likable physicist named Howard Percy Robertson.
He was a likable physicist.
Sure. He was very, very well liked in his class at Yale.
He would be H. Percy Robertson at Yale, though.
Oh, I guess so. He really...
he wouldn't go by Howie.
He loosened the club tie by going by Howard Percy.
Yeah, so he was from Caltech, and he looked into this thing, and they had this panel, and they met for 4 days, 12 hours, a few hours a day. That seemed a little skimpy to me, but whatever.
Same here.
If you only got 3 hours a day to do.
They just basically went around the room taking turns reading that Life magazine article out loud.
I guess so.
And then discussing what they thought about it.
So Rappelt is still here. He's the head of Blue Book at the time still. Hynek was there. He's still around.
Yeah.
He's never left, right?
No, he's part of this ongoing project.
That's
of
right.
Investigation.
And then other people that were involved that, you know, should have been in the room and were in the room. And they were all presenting what they thought were the most interesting cases to what would be eventually known as the Robertson panel.
Right. And the Robertson panel said, thank you very much, all of you. We'll be in touch. Don't call us. We'll call you. And they issued a final report. And it said that 90% of all UFO cases could be explained by meteorological, astronomical, celestial, known scientific stuff.
Sure.
Technology.
That's believable.
Okay. The other 10%, though,
mm-hmm.
if we spend enough time and energy investigating it, we could also explain those.
Yeah, that's where the BS comes in.
Their conclusion was that given enough time and effort, 100% of all UFO sightings could be explained under known scientific or technological right. explanations.
And no one said, so are you saying that 10% of these are so confounding that you can't explain them? And they went, yeah, but we could.
Right.
We just don't have enough time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's a really passive-aggressive way of saying there is no such thing as aliens.
Yeah, pretty much.
So that is ultimately what they said.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. They did see that this was the fact that people were citing these UFOs, and it was all over the papers.
Mm-hmm.
The craze was a bad thing and dangerous even because the Cold War is heating up like we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets have been known to secretly exploit the American psyche. That never happens anymore, of course.
No.
They don't do anything like that.
Well, it's like you said, this was the Cold War.
That's right. They were known to do this kind of thing, and they thought this is a perfect opportunity for the Soviets to come in, fake reports about UFOs, mm-hmm. get everyone distracted, worked up into a frenzy.
And then they start asking them questions about pulsating and
throbbing. And they said, and not only that, but the Soviets, I read their papers, or I have them read to me, and they don't have any reportings of UFO sightings. So they're clearly, if there are any, they're keeping a lid on it. Mm-hmm. And this is our problem that they can exploit. We can't do the same back to them.
Right. So all the Soviets had to do would be come in and be like, UFOs, UFOs, basically like shouting, you know, fire in a crowded theater, which is illegal, of course, as everyone knows.
That's right.
This is a problem. This is like the way the CIA thought, you know, this is something that they need to do something about. So they decided to basically undo that Cold War hysteria and panic.
Yeah, but they're in a pickle, though, because they're supposed to be tamping down this thing that they don't feel like they shouldn't even be investigating to begin with.
Right. They're denying that something even exists, but continuing to investigate it.
Right.
Right. So what I was saying is they decided to say, okay, we need to get rid of this Cold War hysteria. We need to kind of take the air out of this weird phenomenon in American culture. And they decided to do that by exploiting America with a public relations campaign.
That's right. Very, as you say, Bernaysian. Mm-hmm. And they said, hey, call up Walt Disney.
Yeah.
And they really did. They thought, you know, we're going to get this out in the media. We're going to have we're going to create this propaganda that's going to sweep the nation on TV and in movies and in newspapers, debunking all this stuff.
Right.
Showing like, hey, this is how you explain this stuff.
Right. Saying like, here's this report.
Yeah.
And here's the scientific explanation for it.
Right.
And that they consider that would be very powerful. And I think they're right.
Yeah. Just basically priming America's pump to where if you're having a water cooler conversation and bring something up about a UFO, mm-hmm. there are five people there to say, didn't you see that thing? Like, it's weather balloons.
People love doing that.
Oh, sure.
And if you can arm people with that, they will do it every time. And that actually is a pretty good plan for tamping down UFO hysteria.
It's a great plan.
They also decided, maybe one of the less great parts of the plan, to surveil and keep tabs on UFO groups.
Yeah.
For anti-American stuff, because this was during the McCarthy era, of course.
Yeah.
So everybody was doing anti-American stuff if they weren't painting their white picket fence.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I mentioned Disney and we both laughed, but that was not a joke. They actually did think about, and who knows, maybe they got in touch with Disney about making some propaganda pieces to help them out, because they had done that before.
Chip and Dale originally started out as UFO investigators, but it just kind of, one thing led to another.
They worked on propaganda pieces before. There was one called Donald Gets Drafted, a Donald Duck propaganda film.
Sure.
And they said it never came to fruition, but it would not surprise me if they didn't poke around a little bit.
Right.
Like, in earnest.
Donald Gets Drafted did. That was a one that got released.
Oh, yeah.
You mean like the UFO one?
Yeah, like it wouldn't surprise me if they really did have an official meeting and Disney just said, no, like we're not going to get involved.
They're like, but we have this idea about psychic children. But I guess it's kind of pro-psychic, really. I wonder what the message is in Escape from Witch Mountain. I haven't seen it in so long. I'm sure there's some very clear message that as an adult you'd be like, this is what I was taught.
Yeah, I mean, I saw both of those.
Didn't The Rock recreate that or remake it?
I think so, but I did not.
Recreate makes it sound like he just did it in his head in his living room or something.
he recreated that after dinner one night.
Right. I really think he was in that, a remake.
No, I think you're right. I never bothered.
Oh, I didn't either.
I like that guy, though.
Oh, The Rock is great.
I mean, I don't go see his movies much, but he seems like a good dude, right?
He does seem like a good dude. You have a sense for these kind of things.
Yeah, I've been told. there was one TV show. There was a CBS show called UFOs, Friend, Foe, or Fantasy.
It's a great name.
And is this the one that Cronkite? Mm-hmm. I didn't know if that was a separate one.
Did I write this that poorly? It's part of the same sentence.
No, I know. I couldn't tell if it was me. It was my eyeballs.
Because it says, in the same sentence, narrated by Walter Cronkite.
Yes.
Okay.
No, you did great.
All right. Thank you for reassuring me.
This was in 1966, and this was largely over the Michigan sightings.
Yeah, we'll talk about those in a little bit.
Yeah, just stick a pin in that.
But it was big enough that they brought Cronkite out.
Concrete.
You know who I'm talking about.
Sure, Walter Concrete. That's he's a legend.
You turn him upside down and shake him, he won't come out of the cup. So, but in that documentary, it's very much a pro-skeptic, anti-UFO documentary, where they followed this the Robertson panel recommendations of saying, here's this amazing report of the sighting.
Right.
Here's how it's explained. Here's another sighting. Here's how it's explained. Don't you see now that UFOs are actually really just kind of something? They're not alien.
It's fantasy. They called it friend, foe, or fantasy. They should have just called it UFOs, fantasy.
Right.
Because that was the upshot of it all.
So that Robertson panel report, there's something else that was really interesting about it. It had a very surprising knock-on effect years later. So the panel was impaneled in 1952,
mm-hmm.
I think the year of that UFO fever outbreak. And its proceedings and its recommendations stayed classified until 1975.
Yes.
And
after Blue Book was gone.
Yeah. Years after it was gone. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they figured like, oh, it's fine, whatever, just release it.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. Up to that point, up to 1975, as far as anyone in the American public was concerned, the CIA had just remained quiet on the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was all U.S. Air Force. CIA had nothing to do with it. And so all of a sudden, this Robertson panel comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only their own report, but they also mention an earlier CIA panel that had basically the same conclusions. That showed that very much the CIA was involved in this and that they had covered it up. And to people in 1975, it gave the alien conspiracy theory a real shot in the arm because it showed, no, the CIA was definitely investigating this and they covered it up. So how can we trust anything that anybody says about this?
Yeah, covering it up to begin with just made the cover up. It was a cover-up.
Yeah. It made something that wasn't a cover-up a cover-up.
Yeah, exactly, by covering it up.
And fueled all sorts of conspiracy theories. That's how it works. That's just how it works. The U.S. government, probably any government, will never, ever learn, but that is just how it works.
That's right. There was another report declassified in 98 where the CIA said around the mid-1950s they started observing planes that could fly at high altitudes.
They started creating them.
Yeah. Well, it said observing, so I guess they were just observing what they created.
Man, come on. You can't take everything I say literally.
And we're talking about, remember earlier I kind of teased about the fact that the Soviets might have these spy planes.
All right.
That's because we had spy planes.
Yeah.
The U-2 spy plane, very much top secret at the time.
Yeah, it's like that old adage, when you point in the sky at the Russia's spy plane,
uh-huh.
You got three fingers pointing back at your spy plane.
That's right. It was very much top secret, like I said, and it could go up to 60,000 feet, which is 3 to 5 times higher than any commercial plane could fly at the time.
And yet, commercial pilots are seeing these things and reporting on them.
Well, yeah, because they were silver at first. They weren't painted the cooler black color till later on.
Mm-hmm.
I guess with the touring models that they started to pump out there.
Right.
And they, you know, were very reflective. So at sunrise and at sunset, these things would cast these weird lights and, you know, commercial pilots, because they didn't know this was a thing.
Right.
They would say, hey, there's something going on way up above me. Or people would see them from the ground.
Yeah, flying really fast, really high, and looking like fire.
Yeah, because this started, I think, test runs in the mid-1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So that coincides with a lot of these sightings.
Yeah. So this CIA memo that was declassified in 1998 basically said, by our estimate of that 701 unidentified reports, of the 701 reports
mm-hmm.
that remain unidentified
right.
in Project Blue Book's files, our U-2 and SR-71 test flights can probably account for about half of those.
Right.
Which whittles that number down dramatically.
Should we take another break?
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break and come back and talk about the return of Hynek right after this.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Chuck, this is going so well.
Thanks.
I'm really impressed.
Good.
So, Hynek.
Uh-huh.
You said he returned, but really he never went anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
He's still plodding along, doing his thing. Started out at Project Sign. By this time, it's Blue Book. It's like us with this place.
Yeah.
How many times has it changed hands?
Yeah.
A million.
Same old show, though.
We're still here. We're like the Hyneks here.
That's right.
Of How Stuff Works. So, with the years, however, Hynek himself seems to have changed, and he changed probably earlier than he made it public that he had changed. But he later said, you know what, everybody, I actually think that these UFOs are a thing. At the very least, there's some stuff we can't explain, and we should be investigating them way more scientifically than we are. And that really flew in the face of the public face that he had, which had by the time he came out and said that, had become something of a laughing stock at the behest of the Air Force.
Yeah, like what the change was is Repelt left in 1953, and he was the dude that kind of had it running like a legit investigatory body.
Right.
He left, and then Hynek says it basically just became a PR device, and the stats prove it out. It was the unexplained case rate of up to 25% that we talked about. After Repelt left, that went down to 1%.
Yeah.
Which is just an insult. Even if you're a skeptic, that's an insult.
Right, because again, they would use anything that they could think of, including planets that weren't even visible in the sky at the time. There was very famously one where I think there was a sighting in Oklahoma, I believe. Yeah.
The 1965?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was the Oklahoma State Police, Tinker Air Force Base, and a meteorologist in Oklahoma who was using weather radar at the time, all independently tracked four objects, one of them on radar. And Hynek and the Air Force, who were doing Project Blue Book, representing Project Blue Book, said it was Jupiter.
Yeah.
Which is not a good explanation for four objects that are both visually sighted and show up on radar, because Jupiter doesn't show up on radar, and it certainly doesn't show up as four fast-moving objects.
Yes, and Jupiter wasn't even visible in the night sky on that date.
Right. So this definitely kind of like is a really good example of what Hynek was having to come out and say to the public, you know, toward the end of his camel's back breaking.
Yeah, and here's the thing is he was still slightly skeptical. I mean, I don't know about slightly skeptical. He was still a skeptic, I guess.
Right.
But his whole beef was, and he says this as a direct quote, he said, everything was negative and unyielding in their attitude. Everything had to have an explanation. And I began to resent that. Even though I basically felt the same way, I thought they weren't going about it in the right way.
Right.
So that was the deal, is the Air Force was just sort of an obligatory stamp of not true, it was this.
Right.
And he was like, well, I don't necessarily think it's an alien saucer either, but like, can we investigate it and get like a real explanation at least?
Yeah, that was definitely his thing. And then the other thing was that one through line that has kept skeptics interested in this is credible observers reporting incredible, unexplainable things.
That's right.
So those two things, the Air Force irking him and the way that they were carrying out the investigation and these credible observers, actually caused him to undergo a conversion.
Yeah.
There's a debate over whether it was a slow conversion or a quick conversion. Some people suspect that he was actually a lifelong believer and that he just kind of kept it under wraps.
Yeah.
But even after he underwent this conversion, which has been estimated to have happened around 1960,
yeah,
he kept quiet, as a matter of fact, for years. And he didn't want to stake his personal reputation, his professional career, all that stuff on just coming out and being like, hey, everybody, the Air Force is lying to you, especially considering that the general public by this time had completely bought into the idea that the Air Force was just blatantly and clumsily trying to cover up knowledge of UFOs and their reality.
Yeah, he said he was kind of waiting for the big one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like something so irrefutable that he could actually really go public with it.
Right.
All right, well, let's talk about the swamp gas in Michigan. This is in March 1966, very famous case. There was a sighting over several days, or hundreds of people, that reported glowing objects hovering and flying around Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then a bunch of towns along the countryside between Toledo and Detroit, same mm-hmm. thing. 87 students at Hillsdale College in Michigan. And they all said the same stuff, is that we've seen these objects with red, white, and blue lights. One family even said a UFO landed on their farm.
Right.
I don't know about that one.
Sure.
But you never know.
Yeah, the college students might stretch credibility a little bit. Some
Maybe.
Of them.
But it was a big national story. Hynek went there, and it was basically a frenzy, so much so that he had trouble getting interviews with the witnesses as the official like representative because the press was all over it.
Right. Yeah, the press were eating up all of their time. He couldn't interview them. But he finally did, and he held a press conference. And at the press conference, he said it's possible some of the sightings may have mistaken swamp gas for UFOs.
Yeah.
And in this guy's defense, he said some. He didn't say all.
Right.
He wasn't dismissive about it. It's just something he said. But the press took it and it converted it into all. Basically,
yeah.
The headlines read, Hynek dismisses sightings as swamp gas, and that was that. Like, he had basically said it was all swamp gas. Everybody knew that scores and dozens and possibly hundreds of people across Ohio and Michigan hadn't all seen swamp gas.
Right.
And that was a preposterous explanation, especially if you laid it on the whole thing.
Yeah, Johnny Carson even had an astronomer on to basically refute the swamp gas theory.
There's a headline, Air Force insults public with swamp gas theory. That was in like a legitimate newspaper.
Yeah.
So it was a ridiculous thing it was a dumb thing to say, but I think he said it not realizing that it was going to become the explanation.
Right.
And it was going to make him a further laughingstock. It just so happened that swamp gas thing was the last straw that broke Hynek's back.
Yeah, it broke his back, and there was a senator out of Michigan named Gerald Ford,
mm-hmm.
and he said, I demand a congressional hearing. And they said, who are you? He said, I'm Senator Gerald Ford. I'm going to be president one day.
Yeah, you'll see. I'll fix you good when I'm president.
They said, how are you going to be president? You're a senator. He said, well, it's complicated. You'll see.
Right.
So he demands this hearing, and they held a hearing the following month.
Yeah.
And this is when Hynek really got a chance to kind of publicly out himself as a convert,
mm-hmm.
and said, my recommendation, Senator Ford, watch your step, is UFO sightings should be investigated by scientists and not the military. And this was music to the ears of the military in a lot of ways.
Yeah, they said, he said it, finally.
Yeah, great.
They said, yes, you're absolutely right. We should have somebody scientifically investigate this. And the Air Force, for its part, saw an out of being in this UFO investigating business that it didn't want to be in the first place.
No, they did not.
That in some way, Hynek had just opened the door for them. So they said, yeah, we agree with Hynek. You guys should totally get some sort of scientific study going. And I don't know if it was Congress that hired them or if the Air Force did, but either way, a committee led by a physicist named Edward Condon out of University of Colorado.
Go Buffaloes.
They took up the task of figuring out whether UFOs actually were a thing or not and deserve scientific study.
Right. So this is a 3-year study in the end. And the objective was to really take it seriously as an academic study.
And they did that, right?
No, they didn't. it was really just a smokescreen to get the Air Force out of this business once and for all. Mm-hmm. Because Condon basically, and there was a bit of a drumbeat in the public of like, you're wasting our taxpayer money. There were some people that sure. thought this was super worthwhile. But most people saw it as like, why is the Air Force wasting their time with this stuff?
I would guess that would have been William F. Buckley's position.
Yeah, probably so.
So, yeah, there were some people, especially people in the Air Force, too, are like, this is a dumb thing to do. This is a dumb waste of time. So Condon said, okay, I am possibly the only person on the planet who's in a position to get the Air Force out of UFO investigations. I'll do a little wink, wink, nudge, nudge, ask a few people if it pulsated or throbbed, and then we'll just release a report that says no. And that's exactly what they did. In January of 1969, they released the Condon Report, which was respectably 1,439 pages long.
Yeah, but this quote from Condon, though, in 67, it is my inclination right now to recommend that the government get out of this business. Mm-hmm. My attitude right now is there's nothing to it, but I'm not supposed to reach that conclusion for another year.
So that
that's
really
so smarmy.
It really undermines that 1,439 pages. Really, frankly, whittles it down to about 50, just with that one quote. You
probably
know?
So.
So the Condon Report basically says, hey, everybody, our general conclusion is that nothing has come from the study of UFOs in the past 21 years that has added to scientific knowledge. Careful consideration of the record as it is available to us leads us to conclude that further extensive study of UFOs probably cannot be justified in the expectation that science will be advanced thereby. And the weird thing is, Chuck, is I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
We didn't learn anything except about ourselves from investigating UFOs all these years.
That we know about.
Okay. I'll give you that. Except for toasters. And
did that come from UFO tech?
That's what some people say.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. There's like, if you're a UFO believer, one of the big things people point to is this boom in technology
right.
that came after World War II, around about the time the Roswell crash happened.
Gotcha.
And they point to Wright-Patterson and say, well, we learned a lot from this, and we started making microwaves and Tang and all sorts of stuff, ended up on the moon.
Yeah, those aliens were toasting their bread, and
right.
we got to get in on this.
I like the real version of it where that guy had a chocolate bar, Percy, I can't remember his last name.
Remember
he had a chocolate bar in his pocket
That's
and it
right.
melted when he got too close to a microwave?
That's
He's like,
right.
let's start making popcorn with this thing.
Man, I forgot about that guy.
Percy something. We're going to call him Percy Sledge.
Okay. I was just about to say that.
Were you?
I was.
Nice.
So, I tell you what, let's take a break here, and we'll tell you about what happened with Project Blue Book right after this.
Oh, okay.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, We have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
All right, Project Blue Book closed.
There you go. The suspense was killing me, man.
December 17th, 1969, it was officially closed. The airport sent out a fact sheet and said no UFO has ever been a threat to our national security.
Okay.
They don't recognize any technological developments. There are no extraterrestrial vehicles. And if you're a ufologist, is that what it's called?
Ufologist.
Mm-hmm. Then... you think it's just all one big lie still?
Yeah, there's another documented sighting. Here's the thing. With all these documented sightings, it's like, yes, people did say this.
Right. That's all that means, though,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So it's really tough to kind of, like, as coming from, like, the stuff you should know way to be like, well, to contradict this official report,
yeah.
Here's this other, you know, thing that we should be skeptical of. But there was something that happened at... Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana in 1967, where allegedly 10 of our nuclear warheads were suddenly taken offline while this unidentified object was hovering overhead. And that the people who were tasked with watching the warheads all reported on this, and it was documented, supposedly, and that the Air Force's fact sheet, thus, that this was never a threat to our national security, was a flat lie.
That's right.
Yeah.
So in the end, they Project Blue Book and all of the other projects that came before it investigated over 12,000 sightings. 701 remained unidentified, if you go by that number.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to the military, like you said, half of those were U-2s or Blackbirds.
Right.
Which is like, what, 350 or so?
But even still, okay, so there's 350?
Hey, that's a lot.
Okay, but other people say, no, it's even more than that.
Right, exactly, because these were official investigations, and you didn't even investigate the one that I saw, buddy.
Right.
A lot of that stuff goes on.
That's one. Yeah, and that's actually evidenced in the number of sightings that increased after Project Blue Book. So in 1965... I believe there was 886 reported sightings as part of Project Blue Book.
Okay.
In 2014, there were 8,619. In 2018, there were 3,236. That was a slow year. So a lot of people say the Air Force wasn't actually investigating a lot of these.
Yeah, and granted, this is, you should know, this comes from private groups and citizens who have developed these groups,
right,
for reporting, like the National UFO Reporting Center. Because it's not codified now by the military, so citizens have done this.
Right.
So take that 8,600 number with a grain of salt.
But at the same time, it's not necessarily that these groups are drumming up sightings.
Oh, sure.
There may even be more, because at the time in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the American public generally knew if you saw something, you would contact your local Air Force base.
Right.
I wonder how many people know who to contact if they think they see something
now.
I have
no idea.
I don't either.
I would just drive up to Dobbins and, like, knock on the front gate.
They'd be like, come inside forever.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the other things, one of the other reasons that people say, no, the unidentified number is actually way higher than 700 is because if you take those cases where they say it was Jupiter, it was a weather balloon, it was some stupid thing we just came up with, those cases go from identified to actually unidentified.
Right.
And so that number increases even further. Project Blue Book will never die, friend.
No, it will not. And something else won't ever die is Hynek is the person who developed the very famous Close Encounters rating scale.
Mm-hmm.
If you've seen the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, highly recommend it, first of all.
Sure.
Great, great Steven Spielberg film with the great, great Richard Dreyfuss and sure. Terry Garr, for God's sakes.
Oh, she's in it?
Oh, man, she's so good. I miss her. So the first kind is, and you get 1 point.
It's a rating scale for the believability of a sighting.
Yeah, I just love the point thing.
Right.
I got 2 points. So you get 1 point if you see a UFO within 500 feet.
Okay.
Not bad. Second kind is 2 points, of course. That is a physical effect happens, which is like in Close Encounters, when he's on the railroad tracks, his headlights start going berserk and his truck shakes.
Right.
And the crossing gate on the railroad track goes up and down.
That would be, I wonder if there'd be 2 points for each of those things or 2 points for the experience.
I don't know.
Because, I mean, you're just running those numbers
up.
Yeah,
sure.
It's two for each one.
It blinked again.
Right.
And then finally, the third kind, the old 3 point line, that is when you see an alien or interact with an alien. And obviously in the film, that is when Richard Dreyfuss at the end walks up into that spaceship and takes the hand
of
the aliens.
And probably like the most unbelievable.
Spoiler.
It's a pretty old movie.
And it's called The Third Kind.
Sure. So the most unbelievable part of this whole thing is that Hynek went from the guy who was saying it was a weather balloon.
Oh, yeah.
It was this train pilot saw Jupiter, even though Jupiter wasn't even the sky right then, to the guy who literally wrote the book that founded ufology.
Yeah, what's the UFO experience, a scientific inquiry.
Yeah, he just completely basically switched sides and said, there's a lot of stuff that we can't explain. Here's all these, you know, all this experience that I have investigating these things. Let's go forward and figure this out.
I don't want to be a cynic, but...
Okay.
I wonder what salary he had as a private citizen for years and years doing this, being the face of this. Do you think he was like, it's pretty good money?
Maybe. And then when the time was up, he said...
You know what else makes good money?
Right.
Writing UFO books.
Write some books. Maybe. From what I can tell, he's a respected person in the field.
Sure.
In a lot of fields, actually. I didn't get anything, because whenever, you know, when we research something, if somebody's like that... Somebody's out there sniping them.
Right.
I don't remember this really coming up. The only thing I saw that was that was somebody throwing shade was the idea that he had been a believer all along.
Right.
And that he was actually faking as a skeptic.
Okay.
But he was a pretty believable fake skeptic.
That's right. And here's the deal, though. Things did not stop. There was a classified memo that's not classified any longer from October 1969. Just before Blue Book was terminated, that basically revealed that, like, hey, we're going to still investigate stuff. It's not part of Blue Book anymore, but here's how we're going to do it and what we're going to do. Like, here's the process.
Isn't that astounding?
Yeah, I mean, not really.
But, I mean, there was a memo that was sent out after Blue Book, right before Blue Book was shut down, saying, don't worry, we're still going to have procedure for reporting this stuff and investigating it.
They have to.
It's just not going to be public.
Right, and... Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader at the time, he had his program. It was all over the news where what was it called? The Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program.
Right.
Because I guess Harry Reid thought there's something out there.
For sure.
And we need to look.
It was a pet project of his.
That's right.
You know, both Carter and Reagan claimed to have seen UFOs.
I think I did know that. Mm-hmm. I knew Carter.
Oh, of course, Carter.
I didn't know about Reagan, I don't think.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that. I think we did live at Comic-Con. Didn't we do UFOs?
On UFOs, yeah.
This was better.
I agree.
I think.
I agree.
This feels more, like, real.
Yeah. And, well, if there's anything unreal, it's being at... Actually, it was South by Southwest.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Okay. No comment. But this stuff still goes on, even though that project from Harry Reid was shut down shut down in 2012.
Right.
People involved say, no, we're still doing it. We're still doing that stuff.
Right. And here's the thing. When that came out, this is 2017, the guy who ran that program, It came out and told everybody about it. The New York Times reported on it, used all this breathless stuff, like really jumped to conclusions with the facts. And then other people started reporting on that. And exactly the kind of reporting that was going on in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s about UFOs just continued again in 2017. And this is just probably how it's always going to be.
Yeah, and one of the big things was this 2004 sighting in San Diego from two, I think, Navy pilots.
Yeah.
And then they released the footage just a couple of years ago in 2017.
As part of this New York Times article.
Yeah, they released the video footage. And you can go watch it on YouTube. It was released in December of 2017. It is just, I mean, you can see this flying saucer.
Right.
And you can hear these pilots, these trained Navy pilots.
What the heck?
Yeah, they're like, look at it, bro. He actually said bro.
did he? I must not have had the volume up.
The part where he calls him bro.
Wow.
They describe it as a 40-foot-long tic-tac. And then afterward in subsequent interviews, one of them said it accelerated like nothing I've ever seen before, and I have no idea what I saw that day.
Sure. Saw the newest spy plane from the future.
Who knows?
Well, that's it for Project Blue Book, everybody. I'm sure we left some stuff out. If we did, let us know, especially if you're a ufologist. We want to hear from you. And since I said we want to hear from you, that means, of course, it's time for listener mail.
This is just a little shout out about a couple of references that Brad in Sacramento likes.
Okay.
Thanks for everything over the years, guys. I had to write in to acknowledge Chuck's Striper reference in the Nuclear Semiotics episode. It had me laughing. It took me back. I discovered Striper in the late 90s,
yeah,
which is pretty late for Striper.
It really is.
And they were kind of a joke in my circle of friends, most of them who had grown up involved in the church. To Hell with the Devil has been my favorite.
Was that the name of their album?
I think so.
Okay.
Or maybe it was just a song. Because I know they had an album called The Yellow and Black Attack.
Sure.
I had these.
Yeah.
In my record collection.
No, I know.
I don't anymore.
You lie.
I wish I did.
I'm surprised you haven't gone back and
I might. It'd be a fun party joke.
Sure. Just see how long it takes people to pick up on it.
I would love to hear about Chuck's experience seeing them live. Well, I'll go ahead and tell you. I was into it.
Sure.
When I saw them live.
Like black and yellow spandex? Sure.
Yeah, and the drummer played, he was set up sideways. I remember that was interesting.
Like he was turned perpendicular to the stage, to the crowd?
Yeah, like the drum set was facing the side of the stage.
Why?
Well, I guess because he would sing and the microphone was to his left facing the audience.
Uh-huh.
But I don't. This still doesn't make sense.
No.
So I don't know why they did it.
There's a million ways you can put that microphone that's easier than turning the whole drum kit.
No, I totally agree.
That guy liked his abs is what it was, and he wanted you
maybe
to like his abs as well.
I don't know. If I'm not mistaken, the drummer was the brother of the singer, Michael Sweet. I'm pulling this all out of my hind end.
Out of your heck.
So, Josh, my favorite reference of yours was a while ago.
Okay.
I don't remember all the details, but it had something to do with a scene from Harry and the Hendersons when Lithgow was trying to get Harry to go back into the wild.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you said?
Yeah, I was just describing how he like punches him in the face and says, go!
Yeah.
But I don't remember what that was in reference to.
It wasn't that long ago. I do remember that.
No one remembers, though.
You guys have a way of making personal connection with your listeners, and I can really appreciate that. Thanks for keeping things PG, because I love to listen with my kids.
Oh, yeah.
And that is Brad in Sacramento.
Yeah, man. It's kind of the point now where I feel weird cursing.
I had to get used to it on Movie Crush.
Cursing?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just second nature?
Sure.
Has it become weird on Stuff You Should Know to not curse as a result?
No. I can. There's a dividing line.
Oh, bicameral, huh?
Yep.
Nice. Good going.
I'm just a big dumb animal.
No. No, it takes a lot of verve and grit and zhuzh to be able to curse here and not curse there. Or the reverse. Yeah.
I've always been really good at it because of nieces and nephews and just, I was always hyper aware and still am about being in public and like people being around that I might offend.
Right.
I don't want to be that guy.
That's good, Chuck.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to congratulate Chuck on this amazing sentiment of his, you should follow us on social media. You can go to stuffyoushouldknow.com and check out all of our social links there, or you can send your congratulations directly to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.